Listen to Learn Audio Tapes presents Anxiety, Friend or Foe by Dr. Susan Heitler. Dr. Heitler is a clinical psychologist in private practice at Rose Medical Center in Denver and the author of the widely acclaimed book on psychotherapy, From Conflict to Resolution. Anxiety, Friend or Foe is the third audio tape in Dr. Heitler's series on practical methods of understanding and easing emotional distress. It includes a lecture recorded live at Denver University, followed by studio-recorded replays of vignettes from actual psychotherapy sessions. And now, Anxiety, Friend or Foe, with Dr. Susan Heitler.
Anxiety. To understand anxiety, let's picture two dogs and one bone. What are they likely to do? The first dog could growl, giving off a warning signal that he wants the bone. The second dog could growl, giving off an equal warning signal that he wants the bone. They don't want to get into a fight, so neither of them really attacks the bone or the other dog, nor do they want to give up on that bone, so they don't leave the situation. They hover. They growl, and what would you call the emotion that they would be feeling if they were people?
Anxiety.
Definitely anxiety or tension. Two dogs hovering, growling, tension, anxiety. The conflict that involves neither side taking action, either to leave or to resolve the conflict, will perpetuate feelings of tension and anxiety. It's a kind of a freeze relationship to anxiety. Both sides know the conflict is there. It's in the awareness on both sides. But between awareness and action, there's a standstill. I'll give you an example of one of the most dramatic patients that I've ever had come in with what we call generalized anxiety disorder. That is, she felt anxious all day, every day. She wasn't sure what it was about when she first walked in, because often the conflict is hovering just below consciousness. But it took only about one or two questions, and she blurted out, "I'm afraid I'm going to die." I asked, "Is there anything that you feel?" "I've been having stomach pains for quite a while. It's just getting worse and worse." "They're here, they're here, they're here." "So what have you done about it?" "Well, I went to my doctor. My doctor did some tests. The test came back negative. My doctor said, 'You're so tense, you're upset, just forget it.'" "Well, we talked some more." I said to her, "Are you sure you can trust that information?" She said, "Well, not at all, only I'm afraid to go get a second opinion." "Ah, a fear in conflict with a fear. What are you afraid of about getting a second opinion? Because one of the keys to resolving conflict more effectively is to identify the exact concerns and be as specific as possible." So the question was, "What are you afraid of about getting a second opinion?" She said, "I like my doctor. He's a lovely fellow. He's taken care of me for years. He's like a father for me. I'm afraid I'll hurt his feelings." So we have, on the one hand, the fears and some signs. On the other hand, the fear of hurting her doctor's feelings. We came up with a solution that was a win-win solution. I suggested, "How about if you go ahead and get a second consultation, you will tell your original doctor that you didn't want to do that, but your psychologist insisted that you had to do it because I needed to get more information. So you're just doing it for me. Furthermore, I won't even have you call for a second opinion. I work in a medical building. I'll call a doctor who's upstairs who I trust and ask if he can fit you in right after this session." That session was at 10 o'clock in the morning, At 1 o'clock that afternoon, she was in the operating table. The second doctor said, just by feeling it, there's something wrong here. He opened her up, removed it. This was maybe 6 years ago. She's still alive and well today. That has a happy ending. The point is that when there is anxiety, use it as a friend, as a guide, that there's a conflict that needs to be looked at, brought into full awareness, that the concerns need to be taken seriously. Usually, the concerns need to be attended to by getting more information. The best antidote for anxiety is information. And then, once there's information, it becomes possible to move from that anxious hovering state into action or plan of action. That's the good news, that anxiety can be really helpful. Is anxiety always helpful? No. Because just like the wheels on your car are very helpful, they enable you to move forward, right? Not always. Sometimes the wheels start spinning. They get stuck in a rut. When wheels are spinning, it's the equivalent of what can go wrong with anxiety when instead of leading to clarifying the concerns and getting information and getting action, the concerns just go around and around and around. Worrying. Now, worrying is something that all of us at some time in our lives have done and that some people do more frequently than others. Is worrying productive? Almost never. Thinking is productive. Worrying is something different. Tires going around making forward momentum, that's productive. Tires spinning and spinning and spinning just dig a deeper hole. Let's look at a situation of a woman, let's call her Carol, who was spinning her tires with worrying, going around and around, and with each revolution getting more and more anxious to the point that she probably was inadvertently making herself sick. This was a situation of test anxiety. Do any of you get anxious when you take a test?
I get nervous.
You get nervous. Nervous, anxious, tension, those are three synonyms. First of all, Carol is somebody who temperamentally is a little bit of a high-strung person. Now, people are born with temperaments. Just like horses and dogs are born with temperaments, some of us are a little more high-strung, a little more brittle, a little more tightly wired than others. And she's on the slightly more tightly wired end. Often the tightly wired, more nervous people are also somewhat more shy. So biochemically, her nature pulls her a little bit towards worrying. When we're somewhat more anxious type people to begin with, tightly wired temperamentally, a second thing can happen, which is that ambiguous circumstances, when we're not quite sure what's going to happen, if internally we tend to be anxious people, we will tend to read that circumstance as more threatening and having a negative outcome than if we're biochemically feeling a little more easygoing. So when Carol was thinking about the test, she began picturing the worst-case scenario. I'm going to fail. Rather than the best-case scenario or a most likely case scenario being she'd do well enough, she'd certainly pass. Best case scenario being she'd get the best grade in the group. This was actually a licensing exam, and Carol needed that real estate license. Seeing how much she needed it was something else that was increasing the anxiety. But there was one other thing that had happened to Carol that made the anxiety intense for her. In fact, Carol was in her late 30s, early 40s. She wasn't somebody who used to get upset about tests. However, she had taken an evening college class. She enjoyed the class. She went full of enthusiasm to the final exam. Turned out the final exam covered a book that she hadn't realized had been assigned, covered some material that she had thought was peripheral that turned out to be central. The parts that she knew so thoroughly didn't even appear on the exam, so she had done it poorly, probably even failed the exam. It had totally caught her by surprise. Now, Carol's the kind of student who is conscientious and usually gets good grades. That one experience made a strong impression on her. So whereas up to that point, she'd gone quite cheerfully to exams, since that one experience, the word test alone could set her heart palpitating. Sometimes even opening books made her nervous. Clearly, looking ahead to that licensing exam made her highly anxious. That points out another aspect of anxiety. We all tend to remember what's gone wrong much more clearly than we remember what went right. 37 years of taking exams effectively went out the window compared to that one experience of having a trauma associated with taking the exam. Question.
When I was younger, I loved horseback riding and I rode for about 6 years. But every time my mother would drive me to the stable, on the way there, I would get sick. I would be nauseous and get sick every single time. But I love to ride. How would you explain that situation?
Psychologists use the term conditioning. Conditioning can occur because of incidents that have been scary. Something must have happened to you that associated fear with horseback riding. It could have been a story you heard about somebody else. Could have been something that happened to you. Conditioning is a word that applies also to what happened to Carol from that one traumatic exam. It's a particular kind of conditioning, though, because it came out of a trauma, and it was overlearning. That is, she not only was conditioned to be fearful of exams that would have books and college credits associated, but almost anything associated with tests began to have a negative, scary feel to her. There were some other concerns of, how well am I prepared? Will I succeed if I become a real estate broker? Will the test be a fair test? If a person is going to move from worrying or from intense anxiety to constructively using anxiety as a friend, not as a foe, the key is to begin to identify specific concerns. Carol and I began to look at what were the specific concerns that her anxiety was bringing up. We kept in mind that the anxiety came up first and the concerns were secondary. That is, the anxiety to this test came up because of the prior failure she'd had before. And then once she was anxious, that led her thinking to all the possible negative things that could happen in that test. So the causality can go in either direction. We can feel anxious because we're thinking about concerns, or we may be thinking about concerns because we already feel anxiety, and hers was the second type. In any case, reducing feelings of worrying and anxiety can also go from two directions. We can just change the feeling directly, for instance, by breathing deeply or picturing lying on a beach in a very relaxed way. Or we can address the thoughts by getting information and a plan of action for the thoughts. We can stop the worrying and the anxious feeling. The first antidote that we used for worrying was to identify specific concerns. We looked at how fair the test was. She checked out with other people who had taken it, and they said it wasn't their favorite test they'd ever taken, but basically they were tested on the information they had learned from the preparatory course. In that sense, it was predictable, it was fair. Gee, how well do I know the material? What if I don't know it at all, was her other concern. She took a few practice tests to find out how well did she know it. And in fact, she did modestly well on those practice tests. What we're doing is identifying each concern, then obtaining information relevant to that concern. The best antidote for anxiety is information. We took another approach also, which was to look at what would be self-soothing for her to stop the feelings in order to stop the worrying behavior from going on. What were some self-soothing behaviors or thoughts? Well, she said the most soothing was to distract herself and get busy doing other things that made her feel good. A second soothing thought was to remember all the times she succeeded in tests, 37 years of doing well in school, that she just needed to bring back to mind, including some tests that had been very difficult. Then finally, we looked, what are the actions and the distractions? If you think of the word distraction, it's distraction. So there's two kinds of action. Actually, action she could take to allay her anxiety and prevent the worrying, and distraction that she could take to just get out of that rut of spinning and spinning and spinning. And the main actions that she could take, in addition to what I said before about checking out for more information, was to review each night another chunk of the material and to have a plan for very systematically studying so she would really know that she was prepared. The best distractions were work and play. And when she was at work, to work and dig in and be busy. And when she was playing, to invite friends over to be busy during her leisure time. What we've looked at just now are the antidotes to worrying and to anxiety. How to switch worrying, which is just spinning over and over those thoughts of worst-case scenarios, how to convert that into genuine problem-solving, putting aside that tense feeling and going on with life. Let's look at several other cases of the kinds of specific anxiety disorders for which people come to therapists. One is shyness, or as psychologists call it, social anxiety. Anybody in here shy? I chuckle because shy people don't usually courageously put their hand up. I'm impressed with that. But I did see four or five people do what shy people usually do, which is to barely lift a hand up so they wouldn't be too noticed. Shy people are made anxious by predictable situations. One situation that makes shy people anxious is being seen, being visible. That's why shy people don't usually like to speak up in a class, because it shines the spotlight on them. Another situation that shy people generally feel uncomfortable about is anything that's new, including meeting new people. If you meet a shy person, they may be very quiet when they're first getting to know you, and then you won't believe it's the same person if you go home with them, seeing them talking and laughing with their roommates or their sisters and brothers. And as they get to know you, they'll also be talking and laughing, and you'll think, did I think this person was quiet? The particular shy person that came to me that I'll talk about now was named Laura. Laura was a college student who was in her freshman year and having a hard time meeting people. We followed the same formula for anxiety that we've talked about earlier. First step, identify specifically what were her concerns. What specific thoughts brought up anxiety? Well, one concern, if I meet someone new, what will we talk about? We took that concern seriously, and we drew up a list of topics so she would know she had her ready list of topics to talk about for meeting people in elevators, for meeting people in the cafeteria, for sitting next to somebody in a classroom. Second, she was worried if she did reach out and begin to talk with somebody, she would get embarrassed. We talked about what's the nature of embarrassment. Embarrassment is secret joy, and it's okay to feel embarrassed, because at some level, it means that there's some joy in there. She liked that idea until she realized, yikes, when I feel embarrassed, it's all well and good to say that secret joy at meeting this person and getting to talk with somebody and being less isolated. But the problem is, when I'm embarrassed, I blush. My face goes bright pink. We talked about the millions of dollars that women put into cosmetics to make their cheeks go bright pink, and how basically that's quite flattering. She bought it 50-50. It did make her see, though, that maybe having pink cheeks for a few minutes was not the end of the world. It was a mild inconvenience, like hiccuping. It was not the end of the world. Yes, question.
When I'm embarrassed, I don't feel joyful.
People are not enjoyed to feel embarrassed. They are feeling a certain degree of joy at the situation. So for her, for instance, she would feel embarrassed when she was talking with somebody. The secret joy was she was just so happy to be connecting. Check it out next time you're embarrassed. Let's go back to her fourth and most strong fear. The fear, if I talk to people, I'll sound stupid. Now, that turned out to be a tough one. It was clear that this woman was very intelligent and that she was very interesting to talk with as long as she wasn't anxious. The reality, however, was that when people become anxious, they become something like stupid. That is, anxiety does something to people's attention or cognition. It either makes it shrink, so their sphere of attention, if you think of attention as being like a beam of light, it becomes a laser, very pointed. So they're stupid in that they get stuck on one detail and they can't loosen up their thinking and just talk. Or alternatively, their thinking gets so broad, like a broad beam light, that they can't focus on any one thing. They're all scattered. And again, she couldn't get anything out of her mouth. Well, what we decided was that when she was in that extremely anxious state at the beginning of meeting people, she probably would have these two cognitive distortions. That did not mean she was stupid. It just meant that she'd have to be patient until that anxiety died down. She might do well to kind of hang out with people for a while before she really dialogued with them, because that anxiety did tend to die down and her thinking would clear up over time. That kind of a cognitive switch to either being real scattered or being real focused does not mean stupidity. It simply means anxiety. That is what happens to all of us, either heightened focus or splayed out focus. As she felt better about herself, bit by bit, Laura began utilizing some of her topics from her conversation list, bit by bit, did begin meeting people. Do you want the end of the story? She's been out of college about 3 years. She's married. She has a child, and hopefully will live happily ever after. So shyness is one form of anxiety. A second kind that is common is panic attacks. When somebody has a panic attack, they often think, am I going crazy? This is horrendous. The reality is panic attacks, that is hyperventilating, tingling all over, inability to think, feeling of extreme fearfulness. Panic attacks are experienced sometime in their lives by at least 80% of the population. I've had them. Most people I know have had them. So if you have had panic attacks, A, it does not mean you're going crazy. And B, it does not mean you're having a heart attack. The way to make panic attacks become something worse, that is a cause for what we call agoraphobia, or suddenly constricting your life and avoiding situations that could cause a panic attack. The reason that sometimes happens is that people are afraid of the panic attack. So the first thing I usually tell people about panic attacks is they are equivalent to blushing or hiccups. They are phenomena that are a normal part of existence. They're just a heightened moment of anxiety that will come and then go. They're a splurge of adrenaline into your system, and as the adrenaline drains out, you'll go back to feeling normal. Next question, other than are panic attacks normal, is what causes panic attacks? The third question will be, what makes them go away? Those two are quite linked. Panic attacks occur because some scary thought has fluttered by like a butterfly, blipped in, and then gone away. So it left the fear with no cognitive awareness of where did this fear come from. We don't call it a panic attack if a truck is rushing towards us and we jump back and it misses us just in the nick of time. We just call that, boy, I was scared and I did something quick and it's fine. We call it a panic attack if we're getting the fear as if we're about to be hit by a truck, but we don't see any truck. We're saying, you know, where'd that come from? It just came out of nowhere. It came out of nowhere because the frightening thought fluttered away like the butterfly. When I ask the question about anxiety, is it a friend or is it a foe? I like to think that even intense anxiety, like a panic attack, is potentially friendly. If we can use it to chase after that butterfly and track down what was that thought that got me so scared. I like tracking down those thoughts because there's usually a certain amount of detective work that you have to do. You need to think, what was the last thought I was aware of before that panic came? Or what was the last anything that I was aware of I'll tell you why I say anything, because often it's not a full thought. For instance, let's take the case of Joseph. Joseph went through a phase in his life where he had many panic attacks, and it developed into agoraphobia, that is, a fear of leaving his home. I asked him, when was your first panic attack? His first panic attack was going into a restaurant. Sometimes panic attacks are called the restaurant syndrome because people most often have panic attacks in restaurants because they're hungry. When you're a little bit hypoglycemic, your body is more prone to have those adrenaline spurts. In any case, Joseph had it going into the restaurant. But lots of people go into restaurants and they're hungry and they don't have panic attacks. So there had to be that little butterfly, some thought, flittering by. The last thing Joseph could remember before having the panic attack was noticing a large painting on his right. When we're trying to find concerns, we get very specific. What was it in that painting that caught your attention? Well, there was a big splotch of red. What did that red remind you of? Or what does it remind you of now? Oh, it was the same color red as the shirt that my boss was wearing that afternoon. What was it about your boss that might have caused a panic attack? Oh, he announced that afternoon that the business is closing and I'm going to be losing my job. That's why you have to be a detective to track down that little butterfly and find out what was the scary thought. What was his scary thought? I'm losing my job. Second panic attack Joseph had. This panic attack illustrates another aspect of the kinds of butterfly thoughts that scoot so quickly away. He had it as he drove up to the Safeway, the big grocery store a couple blocks from his house. Now, what do you think of when you hear the word Safeway? Well, the thought that scooted by Joseph's mind when he saw the big sign that said Safeway was, I took the safe way in taking that job, and now they are closing down that business. You can see how symbolic the panic attacks can be. Next panic attack Joseph had when he was about to go over a bridge. What does that say to you? He was frightened of crossing the bridge onto the next stage of his life. If people are afraid of panic attacks, as I said earlier, they can begin to avoid situations which in the past have triggered a panic attack. By now, he was avoiding restaurants, because that's where the first attack came, bridges, grocery stores. You can see how panic attacks and agoraphobia can develop. I'll just give you one more example, see if you're catching on to the idea of how you translate panic attacks. The next panic attack came when Joseph did brave the fear and go into the grocery store. As he was walking down the aisle, he had another panic attack. What do you think was the other thing he was afraid of? Getting married, walking down the aisle. If I'm going to lose my job, how can I get married? Anxiety is not a stop sign. Anxiety is like a yellow blinking light. When you see a yellow blinking light, you slow down, you become cautious, and you look and see what the problems are, and you keep going. If you want anxiety to remain a friend that guides you to your important concerns rather than a foe that stops your life, remember, anxiety is a yellow light. It says proceed. You can be afraid and still go ahead and do what you want to do. When you get anxious, say those words, anxiety is just a yellow light. It's not a stop sign. I can be afraid and still go ahead and do what I want to do.
This concludes the lecture portion of our tape. We continue now with studio-recorded examples of psychotherapy in which conflicting desires, fears, and our values have been blocking action and producing anxiety. In the following vignettes, actors replay segments of actual psychotherapy sessions. Musical notes and indicate commentaries to the audio listener. In the first example, a young man is torn between following his dreams and listening to his more cautious inner voices. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
What's on your mind today? What would you like to focus on?
I've been kind of stressed out. I get these adrenaline rushes. I can't sleep.
What's the main thing you've been thinking about?
Well, I'd like a career change. I've always wanted to be a musician. To do that, I would have to pretty much give up the computer programming I've been doing now for about 6 years. And that's a difficult thing to do.
I'm struck as you tell me that. It sounds like you're asking me, what's the underlying question, if you had to focus in on what it is you're asking me?
Is it okay?
Okay. Sounds like we better talk about that, because ultimately, clearly, you're the one that will need to make that decision, whether it's okay or not. How have you been going about making that decision?
Well, I go back and forth, really, between the two. I want to become a musician. I want to pursue that. But at the same time, my job offers me security and comfortable living, which I may have to sacrifice. So I really go back and forth between the two. It just spins around in my head.
Mm-hmm. Your hands, as you're talking, first are going back and forth, and then they start spinning. That's how you've been feeling?
Yes.
A difficult decision can easily evoke anxiety because decisions almost inevitably involve elements that seem to be in conflict. Let's pinpoint the concerns on both sides. Close your eyes for a moment and picture being a musician. What do you see?
I see myself in front of people.
I see you smiling as you say that.
It almost comes to me like a rock video.
As you picture yourself actually becoming a musician like that, what are the buts that begin to come up? Thoughts and images that come up with the word but help us to clarify the concerns that inhibit Steve from moving forward with the career he wants.
Well, I don't know if I'm any good. Mm-hmm. So there's a potential to fail. I don't always know what that comprises, failure, but that seems to be this big neon sign flashing over my head. You could fail.
So, question of how good you are, number one. Number two, could I fail?
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts or concerns that come up as you picture that scene?
Actually, I see my father in the background with this sarcastic grin on his face, telling me that I'm not going to succeed. Actually, that I should just stay with the career that I have.
What do you think his thinking is that would make him suggest you stay with your career? The shoulds that block our want-tos often have their source in comments from our parents. Although many of these shoulds guide us helpfully, some need revision as we grow older. One key to easing anxiety is to bring these semi-conscious shoulds out into full awareness. Once we are aware of a parental or societal message, we can decide for ourselves if it represents a value we continue to cherish, or a rule that needs modification.
He has always taught me that's what I'm supposed to do, is choose a career and grow through that career. And I think a musician's lifestyle is not something that a family man would do, or that a son of his would do.
Mm-hmm. As you're talking now, Steve, I'm making notes and listing the concerns that you've expressed, the concerns that lead you to want to become a musician, and all in the same column, the concerns that lead you to feel that you should stay in the work you're doing now. Often when people are making a decision, they make two columns, I should do it and I shouldn't do it, or stay or leave, stay a programmer, become a musician, that they bounce back and forth between two alternatives. Your head's going up and down. Does that feel like what you've been experiencing?
Yes.
What we're doing now is a different process. List all the concerns into one column and then come up with a solution set that meets the concerns on both sides. That's the process we'll go for.
Okay.
Let's move forward then one by one with the concerns that you've listed. First, what came out to me very clearly, particularly from the smile on your face as you were talking, is how much pleasure you get when you visualize yourself as a musician.
Yes, I have always wanted to do that, and I think I would enjoy it very much.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that image goes to something very deep within you of who you are in this world.
Yes.
Second concern that came up was a negative concern. Am I good enough? Tell me realistically what you know about your skill level and your talent level. Clarifying concerns helps to identify what additional information Steve needs to seek out. Remember, information is often the best antidote to anxiety.
It's a big blank, really. Am I good enough?
Mm-hmm. How could you get information on how far along toward being a professional musician you are?
To get feedback, I suppose I could make a stab at just playing in public or talking to somebody in the industry, maybe.
So what we're moving toward is to use those questions that come up and make you anxious. Am I good enough? As guides for the action you need to take. You need feedback from people that says whether you have potential to be professional caliber. How do you feel as we concretize that piece of the plan?
That sounds really good. That makes sense, actually, because I don't feel like I always have enough information. Mm-hmm. So that might be a way, definitely, to get some more information towards making a decision.
Sometimes additional information leads to the opposite of what we had expected or wanted. Planning ahead, contingency planning, helps us to be prepared so that potential disappointment becomes simply a shift in direction. What if some of the news is you've got a lot of skills, you've got a lot of talents, and you're way far away from being able to make a living at it?
Wow. Bummer. I don't know. I suppose I definitely want to finish the year anyway with the programming, so maybe I could just make the extra time on the side somewhere and try to improve.
Liz and I both toward improvement and getting feedback.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now you're beginning to cook toward an integrated solution. Let's keep going. What about that notion of failure? Where does that idea come from? The specter of failure often inhibits taking action toward something we want.
Well, I think that's also linked with my father's voice.
What do you hear?
That I'm not good enough. Nothing is ever good enough. A report card with B's on it rather than straight A's was never good enough.
Now, as an adult, what's your next thought after you hear that voice that says you're not good enough?
Oh, he must be right.
Do you want to rest with that?
No, I'd like to move past that, but it's such a strong voice, and it's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. How would you like to respond to that voice? What kind of response would leave you feeling comfortable?
I am good enough. I'd like to be able to show or to prove. Actually, to tell you the truth, I would like to have some unconditional support from my family, but that doesn't seem to be possible, so...
What would unconditional support sound like?
It would sound like, well, Steve, I know it's going to be difficult, but I'm behind you and I want you to be happy, so follow your dreams and do it. Do what you want to do, and your mother and I will be there for you if you need us. Something like that.
Sounds good. How do you feel as you say that?
Good.
Can you say that to yourself, knowing that they may or may not be able to join you in that process?
I think I could get to that point where I could feel good about saying that, yeah.
What would you need to get to that point?
I guess I need to just prove to myself that I'm capable. So maybe by doing something mm-hmm. about the question so that I have something to look at and say, see what I've accomplished, I can do this.
Mm-hmm. If you encourage yourself enough to at least travel down the road of trying, then the odds go up that you'll get to a point where they will also appreciate what you're doing. And there may be a period of time when you're going down that road on your own.
Yeah. I hope I could get to a point like that. I hope they mm-hmm. could get to a point like that.
Right. And if they are not able to get to that point, is it still worth going down the road?
I don't know, but I think I would do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you would really like your parents to appreciate more fully what you're trying to do and be supportive of you. You can talk with them about what you're doing so they'll understand it more and come along that road with you. Would that be helpful?
I think so, yeah.
Let's put that on the agenda, to talk with them more so that they see this as you do. Because you're not a little boy who just has to do what they say now. You're a grown person. What are you, 29. Does that make you old enough to make some of your own life choices? I see you smiling again.
Yeah.
Okay. There were two other concerns you raised. One was about having a straight line career course. Right now, as you think about that, what comes up for you?
Well, there is security in that, it seems. Also, I'm bored.
With what you're doing.
Flat out, yeah. And when I project myself 10 years down the line, even 5 years down the line, the picture doesn't become any more pleasant to look at.
What kind of career course looks less boring and more appealing to you?
Well, absolutely becoming a musician or following my dreams anyway. Something a little less rigid, less structured.
So that straight line career course, which was more rigid and structured, sounds like it fit for perhaps your dad. And for you, you need to find a different kind of a path.
Yes.
The last concern was, what about becoming a family man, supporting your family economic success?
Well, it's not a concern at this point.
Because?
Because I'm single.
Do you have plans to become married?
Yes, actually I would. I would like to be married.
How much time do you see before then?
Oh boy, 5-10 years maybe.
That gives you a 5-10 year window to build a career as a musician and get economic stability, or at least find out if that's a possibility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's look over the talking we've been doing.
Okay.
Can you see a solution now that would take into account the concerns both that were keeping you at the work you have been doing and that motivate you to move into being a musician? Can you see a total package solution?
I think so. I need to find a way to get more information about what being a musician really is about and if I fit into that. Also, I need to talk with my parents because their support is important to me. Whether or not they do support me, I at least need to move forward with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to just give myself a break, give myself some room to explore and experiment a little bit and relax into what I enjoy.
Sounds good.
It sounds good to me, too.
Any pieces feel unfinished?
No, that's a good place to start.
Bravo. Why does Steve feel calmer at the end of this discussion? When a decision evokes a tug of war between two opposing plans of action, people generally have been thinking about the problem by going back and forth between the two options, maybe listing the pros and cons on both. Steve and I utilize a different decision-making paradigm to avoid a tug of war. First, we switch our focus from specific career plans to talking about the underlying concerns and objectives to which these career options have been potential solutions. Second, we consolidate all of these underlying concerns onto one list. Third, we then design a new plan of action that addresses all of the underlying concerns and goals. Case two. Orientation toward the future is characteristic of anxiety states. We usually worry about dangers we see ahead. Expectations, though, for these future dangers, that sense of trepidation, usually comes from some experience that we've had and learned from in our past. In this next vignette, Trudy and I discuss a current problem with deep roots in the past. Good morning, Trudy. What's your goal for this session? You want to start going out and meeting men.
Yes, I'd like to have someone special in my life.
Are you doing that?
No, I just can't go into that situation.
Can't?
I become so anxious. I become so nervous inside.
Let's look at what that nervousness inside is about. Close your eyes. Focus inside on what you're calling nervousness. What do you feel, and what does it look like inside?
Inside, I feel incredibly shaky. It's like when you look at a TV screen with static all over it. That's what I feel like inside.
Hmm. Is that a feeling you remember having had earlier in your life?
Yes. When I was younger, mm-hmm. with my parents, ever since I can remember.
Ever since you can remember. Chronic anxiety stemming from childhood can indicate an anxious temperament or can indicate childhood traumas. In this case, traumas and their impact on Trudy's self-image are the difficulty. Let's go back to some early times that you remember when that feeling would come up. Who do you see in the scene?
My mother.
And what do you see happening? What do you hear?
She's telling me that was a stupid thing to say.
And you feel?
I feel like she must be right.
What's another scene that comes to mind?
When I think of my father, I just picture the way he looked at me as if he was looking right through me.
Looking right through you.
Staring right into my soul.
What's your sense of what he would see?
He looks at me like I'm filthy.
And the feeling in you is that same
anxiety, that same shaky feeling.
Mm-hmm. These memories suggest excessively critical parenting from Trudy's mother and the possibility of some sexual innuendos or perhaps even actual abuse with her father. Subsequent therapy sessions confirmed that both parents were abusive in their parenting. The mother in her ongoing verbal assaults and the father with periodic sexual contacts. The impact of these negative assaults on Trudy was a negative self-image. Since self-image is built from the messages others give to us in their actions and words toward us. So those are the feelings that come up now, being chastised for being stupid or filthy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at that feeling again and see how we can change those feelings right now in the present. Is that feeling still in you right now?
Yes.
Like the static on a TV?
Yes.
Now, as you focus on that shaky feeling, like shaky static, allow some almost magical something to happen that begins to soothe that shakiness. What do you see?
I see a warm blanket covering my middle.
How does the shakiness begin to change as that warm blanket covers your middle?
It blocks out the static. The warmth helps me to be able to breathe.
What's happened now to the static?
It's calm.
Allow that warmth to permeate your whole body, checking out if there's any other little pieces of static left anywhere else in your body that need to be calmed and soothed with the warmth of the blanket. In using imagery as a method of calming tensions, it's helpful to be certain that the new image pervades a person's whole being. Then, as the feelings change, thoughts begin to change. Thoughts are filed by feeling state. So as Trudy begins to feel better, you'll hear that she accesses more positive information about herself and about others. What is the feeling now throughout your body?
It's like a warm, bright light.
As you feel that warm, bright light within your body, what do you begin to know about yourself that's different from what you were thinking about yourself when you felt the shakiness?
That I do have something valuable to offer to someone else.
As you begin to think about what you have of value to offer somebody, picture yourself going out and meeting men. What are you aware of as you see yourself out meeting people now?
They must want just as badly as I do to find someone to be with.
Mm-hmm. With that thought, what happens with that warm, bright glow?
I guess that it's okay to allow myself to be vulnerable to that person without fear.
You still sound a little hesitant as you say that. What was the hesitance that came up just then?
That person may try to take advantage of me, or I may be hurt by that person.
Mm-hmm. Trudy's hesitance and her use of the word vulnerable suggests that she still regards male-female interactions as potentially dangerous and hurtful. This wariness is understandable, given Trudy's experiences as a child with her father and with her mother. The relaxation technique has enabled her to feel calmer and confident enough that she is able to implement what she envisioned. She was able to go out and begin to meet men. Our work, however, in therapy wasn't over. In subsequent sessions, we continued to look at her self-image and rectify the negative elements that had come from her childhood. In addition, we talked at length about the qualities that she wanted to seek in a man so that she wouldn't inadvertently choose another man that would repeat the painful and damaging relationship she had had with her father. Case 3. Steve's success at his job resulted in an honor that provoked stressful tension. The antidote to stress, like to other forms of anxiety, has two steps. First, carefully list the concerns. Second, design a responsive plan of action. Good morning, Steve. Welcome. What's up today?
I'm very nervous.
Nervous?
Yeah. I have a talk to give tonight, and I've never done that before, and I'm very anxious about it.
Let's focus right in on what that nervousness is about.
Okay.
Close your eyes for a moment. Can you hear some thoughts going around in your head? Or do you see some images that scare you?
I see myself standing at the podium being a complete failure.
Anxiety about public speaking can be triggered by any number of underlying concerns. Steve's anxiety comes from imagining worst-case scenarios and, at some level, assuming that these are actually going to come true.
There's no response to anything I've said. In fact, the audience seems quite bored, and I see myself sweating and choked up, and I don't know what to say, and it just deteriorates on this downward spiral until I just explode right there on the spot.
Explode on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then what happens?
I get fired and lose my job. They never ask me to talk again, and everybody makes fun of me, and I'm the joke of the office for the next 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got a list of concerns to go through. Let's go through them one by one.
Okay.
What we've done so far is follow through all the way to the worst-case scenario, so we know the full list of concerns. Now we're going to back up. I'll say them as I heard them. One, that you'll be something that you will label failure. Number two, that there'll be no response from the audience. Number three, that the audience will be bored. Number four, that you'll be sweating. Number five, that you won't know what to do or say. Six, boy, we have quite a list here, was that after you explode, you'll get fired. You'll lose your job. They'll never ask you to speak again. And you'll be an office joke. Did we miss anything?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we first focus specifically on the concerns, we feel worse, not better. It's okay. When we get through the end, you'll feel better, not worse.
Okay.
And if you don't, let me know.
All right.
Got a deal?
Yes.
Let's proceed. Identifying the specific concerns enables us to use a strategy that mediators call chunking, that is, breaking up the overall problem into small component parts. Let's start at the beginning. What would be a complete failure?
If the audience gets nothing out of my speaking.
Ah, what would you like them to get out of your speech?
Well, some useful information.
As we clarify each specific concern or fear or chunk, we can move into devising a solution to that specific piece. Solving a series of small problems is far easier than trying to come up with one overall solution. In your preparation, how could you be certain that you include useful information?
I'm supposed to talk about the successful strategies that my team has been using mm-hmm. over the past month. Mm-hmm. Instances that occurred this month that would be useful.
When people tell specific instances, specific anecdotes or stories, does that usually catch up your interest?
Yes. Because mm-hmm. I can relate to them.
How many incidents do you think you'll talk about?
Well, I can think of three right off the top of my head.
In preparing talks, people typically say you want to make no more than three main points.
Oh.
So by giving three incidents, you've got your talk structured already.
Oh, good.
How are you feeling right now?
Relieved.
Mm-hmm. What was the thought that gave some relief?
I feel like I have a plan of action. I'm not in the dark about how to set up the speech.
Mm-hmm. Good. We're moving forward. As you picture yourself relating those stories and giving pointers for success, do you have any more concerns about whether they'll be interested?
I don't want to sound like I'm bragging about how wonderful I have been over the past month. I'd like to focus on just the work itself.
Mm-hmm. So keeping focused on the work itself, not you as a person.
Mm-hmm. I'd like it to be entertaining as well.
Mm-hmm.
A dry speech.
What's the alternative to dry? What would keep it entertaining?
Some jokes, maybe.
Some jokes, maybe. What else keeps it entertaining?
When the speaker is lively.
What can you do to keep it lively?
Wear a nice tie.
Well, I can see you spontaneously come up with jokes.
I guess it's just in the delivery.
Mm-hmm. What in the delivery will keep a talk lively?
My manner, some jokes.
Some jokes and?
Pace. That would work too.
Mm-hmm. To keep the pace up?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if you sprinkle in some of your natural sense of humor, like the comment about the tie, and keep the pace up. You know the topic is inherently of concern, how that success was managed, your group and the steps, the actual activities that were done. How are you feeling now? Are we on track?
Absolutely. I want to get started.
Sounds good. Let's just be very quick then about going through the other concerns.
Okay.
What if you get fired? You could become a musician, I guess.
That's true.
So maybe there's a secret wish there that it would be nice if you could get fired and go to full-time.
Maybe.
Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, but I don't think I'll get fired. That's an extreme fear.
I think you're right. If you've been so successful that they're asking you to give this talk.
They're not looking to get rid of me anytime soon.
Right. They may or may not ask you to give more talks. that's different from your job being in jeopardy.
Right.
Okay, sometimes when we're fearful, our fears run away. We expand and expand. Oh, not only will it be a bad talk, but no one will like me afterwards, or I'll lose my job, and my life will be over, etc. What's happening now as you're calming down is you're seeing that the problem is the talk, not job loss, etc. Is that accurate?
Yes, yes, definitely.
Okay, let's see if there's any other pieces of the old worries that you still need to be concerned about. You're thinking you won't get fired. You're unlikely to lose your job. At worst, do you think they may never ask you to give a talk again?
Could be, but if the talk is causing me this much anxiety to begin with, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing anyway.
Okay. And the possibility of people in the office then looking down on you after the talk?
I'm a computer programmer. I'm not Bob Hope or somebody who is known for their public speaking. So I'll just do the best I can, really.
That sounds very realistic.
Yeah.
Good. Sum up your plan of action, then.
Okay. I'm going to prepare the speech using the three specific instances that have occurred this month at work. I'm going to add some jokes, if I can. I'm going to keep up the pace when I'm speaking so that I appear lively. And I'm going to dismiss those irrational fears of losing my job or...
You're going to dismiss them?
They've pretty much evaporated, yeah.
So it's pretty much. They still come up from time to time, and you may occasionally have to actively dismiss them.
Yeah.
How will you do that?
I have to make the choice to say I'm not going to focus on those fears.
Telling yourself that you'll not do something is far less effective than telling yourself what you will do. So I encourage Steve to decide what he will do as those fears come up. What will you focus on instead?
The actions.
The actions of preparation we've been talking about today.
Yeah.
Exactly. Getting into a task as opposed to sitting back, immobilizing, speculating extremes of awful things that could happen. Getting into the task will be a big help in continuing to keep the anxiety level down and the enthusiasm up.
Yes.
How are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling good.
Good.
I'm feeling good.
You sound eager to get out there and start preparing.
Yeah, I need the afternoon to work on it.
Okay. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Let's look back now on the question posed in the title of this tape. Is anxiety a friend or a foe? The answer, as to so many questions, is both. Tension, stress, and nervousness can indeed feel unpleasant. Physiologically, nervousness can put tension into body movement, a problem for athletes, and definitely does constrict intelligent thinking in some instances, making nervousness an impediment for decision-making in social situations and for public speaking. The good news is that well-managed anxiety can help us. Fear warns us of very real dangers ahead. Prolonged anxiety informs us that an underlying conflict needs our attention and resolution. Anxiety is not a stop sign. Like a blinking yellow light, anxiety signals us that we need to pause, gather information, and then proceed. The pause enables us to focus explicitly on the fears, desires, and values that seem to be in conflict. Amazingly, then, impasses become passageways. Anxiety melts into action. Anxiety then proves to be a motivator, a guide, and a friend.
This concludes Tape 3 in Dr. Heitler's series of audio tapes on understanding and helping emotional distress. The information on this tape is expanded further in Dr. Heitler's book, From Conflict to Resolution, published by Norton & Company. From Conflict to Resolution can be purchased in bookstores or from Listen to Learn audio tapes. Other audio tapes by Dr. Heitler include Conflict Resolution for Couples and Depression, a Disorder of Power. Dr. Heitler also offers Working with Couples in Conflict for psychotherapy professionals. For more information or to order Dr. Heitler's book or tapes, contact Listen to Learn Audio Tapes, 1-800-919-8899, or write to Listen to Learn, 4500 East 9th Avenue, Suite 660, Denver, Colorado, 80220.